Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack Andrea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's program, you're going to be hearing from the artist in residence of the Racine Symphony Orchestra. Their newest classical season gets underway this weekend. And then in part two of today's program, we remember one of the most renowned singers of the 20th century, Jesse Norman. You'll hear a portion of the memorable morning show interview that I was able to record with her back in 2014. Stay with us. And one of the most exciting events of this coming weekend will be the season opener of the Racine Symphony Orchestra performing at the Rita, the University of Wisconsin Parkside, in, of course, beautiful Francis Bedford Hall. And it will be a concert that features music of Beethoven and Mendelssohn and Haydn with Maestro Pascal Arino on the podium. And as part of the occasion. It is the first opportunity for many people to meet in person the 2019 artist in residence for the Racine Symphony Orchestra, Megan Heinrich, who will be engaged in a pre-concert conversation in Bedford Hall beginning at 2 o'clock Sunday afternoon. And I'm very, very happy to be able to get acquainted with Megan via the telephone to find out a little bit about her own musical life and about what she is excited to be doing with the Racine Symphony over the course of this season. Megan Heinrich, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much.
Tell us, first of all, where you come from originally and at least the capsule summary version of the road that has ultimately taken to you to this position with the Racine Symphony.
Well, it has been a long and winding road indeed, so I will try to give the nutshell summary. I actually grew up in a small town in Huntington, West Virginia, where there wasn't a whole lot of classical music, but I discovered, thanks to a wonderful private teacher and band director, that I wanted to play the oboe. I got to play in my youth orchestra. It was the only one in the state of West Virginia, and that was really some of my first exposure to playing orchestral music, and I really fell in love with it, so much so that I went to the North Carolina School of the Arts for high school, went on to study oboe performance at the Cincinnati College Conservatory of Music, and did my master's at Rice University in Houston, Texas. Along the way of that college journey, I discovered that I was as much interested in sharing my love of music with people of all ages as I was in just playing and performing that music. I did an independent study during my master's degree with the wonderful flute professor, Leon Bicey, about community engagement and education. We started a concert series where we brought young people from area schools into the Shepherd School for chamber music performances. And I had this idea. I want to do this thing where I'm educating about music, but I don't want to be a middle school band director. And at the time, the word was just starting to be thrown around, and I thought, yes, that's what I want to do. I went on to be a part of an amazing group called Tales and Scales. Tales as in stories, and scales as in music. We did occasionally get phone calls asking us if we brought snakes to kids' birthday parties, but that was not the case. We performed commissioned music by up-and-coming composers that told stories that were appropriate for children and families, and we drove around the country in a minivan with all of our musical equipment and performed these music tales. We played all of the music on our instruments from memory. We moved around the stage, and we acted out the parts in the story. And it was really the only thing like it happening in the country. It was something very special to be a part of, and I think it gave me a unique perspective on what music can do. So I then went on from there. It wasn't really a sustainable career for the rest of my life. I had married my husband at that point, who is a bassoonist, and we wanted to have a family. So our work took us to Alabama and then to Cleveland and finally to Milwaukee, where my husband is now assistant principal bassoonist with the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra. And I have found my niche in a little bit of everything, playing and teaching oboe, teaching early childhood music classes at the Wisconsin Conservatory of Music, and doing pre-concert talks for a variety of orchestras all around the area. And I am so excited to be sharing that with the Racine Symphony for the first time.
Fantastic. It sounds absolutely terrific. I want to return to one thing you talked about in your capsule biography, the fact that you grew up in a place where there was very little classical music. I wonder, what was that like for you as a young person to be, in a sense, nurturing a passion that I am guessing very few, if any, of your schoolmates and friends and perhaps relatives shared? What was that like? And what difference
Absolutely.
Do you think, and what difference do you think that has made in terms of your own relationship with and appreciation for great music?
That's a great question. You know, I think it made me that much more determined to make it happen and make it work. The fact that there wasn't just a built-in support system around me. I had to find those support systems myself, and I was so lucky to be surrounded by people who did support me. My parents played their Reader's Digest Beethoven LPs at the dinner table every night, and so I was hearing this music. We had a piano in our house, and I was able to take piano lessons. I did have a band program at my middle school and a very nurturing band director who helped me get started. And I think one of the real differences, my first saxophone and oboe teacher, Ann Bingham, was also on the faculty at Blue Lake Fine Arts Camp in Michigan. And she encouraged me the summer after sixth grade to go to Blue Lake for 2 weeks. And that was when I met all of these other kids my age who wanted to play in band and orchestra, who wanted to make music. And, you know, that was not the case at my middle school. People just didn't understand this thing that I was interested in, and they, you know, listened to top 40 radio music, and I would tell them about Brahms, and they just didn't get it. And then suddenly I had other seventh graders to talk about Brahms with, and that just encouraged me. It made me think, okay, these people are out there. I don't know if you ever saw in the 90s, there was a music video, the song No Rain by Blind Melon, where there's a little girl and she's tap dancing in this bumblebee costume, and she kind of goes around her school tap dancing in a bumblebee costume, and everybody looks at her like she's a complete weirdo, and she gets really dejected, and she wanders off by herself, and she comes to this field, and there are all these other people wearing bumblebee costumes.
Ah.
And she becomes elated, and she dances, and the end of the music video is her in this field full of other people in bumblebee costumes. And that's how I felt when I started to discover other people who loved music and were interested in music. Strange metaphor, I know, but I think back to that scene in the music video, and anytime I'm engaged in a conversation with other people who are excited about music, I think, oh, I found another bumblebee.
Right. No, I think that is a very apt metaphor indeed. I like that a lot. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Megan Heinrich, who is the artist in residence with the Racine Symphony Orchestra. And she will be engaged in a pre-concert conversation with the audience this Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock, preceding the concert with which the Racine Symphony opens its newest Masterworks season, a concert which will include music of Mendelssohn, Beethoven, and Haydn. So, Megan Heinrich, when you are talking about music to an audience that is likely comprised of a mix of people, but certainly including plenty of people who might love music but have only the most sort of casual knowledge of it, what kinds of things do you think about? What do you think are some of the most important ways in which one can talk about music and sometimes very complicated pieces of music in front of an audience that is not comprised of musical professionals or people from the world of academia that are as well steeped in the building blocks of music as you are?
Sure. So my idol in terms of talking about music actually comes from the radio world, and it's Carl Haas, who had the show Adventures in Good Music. And I remember listening to Carl Haas when I was in high school and college, and I would listen with my mom, who is a music lover but not a trained or professional musician in any way. And there was this amazing experience where I felt like we both learned something and enjoyed listening to him talk. And I felt like he had this way of speaking about music that someone who had studied and played classical music all their lives could still learn something new and not think, oh, this is boring, I already know about this piece. And he could also ignite this fascination and interest in music to someone who had maybe never listened to or studied classical music. And I thought that is a true gift, to be able to share this music with every kind of person. So I always think back to what it was in his way of talking about music. And because of that, the first thing that I look for when I listen to a piece of music, maybe it's one that I already know very well, maybe it's one that I don't know at all, when I'm going to be speaking to an audience, is I think, what universal human truth does this piece of music have embedded in it? What about this piece of music could every single person understand? What is something that we all experience, that we all go through? And for that, you have to delve into the world of the emotional and not necessarily the technical. So I try to find that emotional aspect, that personal aspect, and then from there think, okay, so what does this composer technically do to make us feel that? How does the craft of the music shape our experience in that way? And when you start from something that everyone understands, like grief or hope or calm, then you can work backwards, and suddenly you are talking about key relationships and harmonic lines and orchestral textures, and people understand them because they're relating them to something that they already feel and know.
This is the first time I think you'll be speaking in front of a Racine Symphony audience. Is that correct?
It's true.
Yeah. But you mentioned that you have done this for various orchestras. I'm just curious if there ends up being very much in the way of difference between the way you introduce a concert with Orchestra X versus Orchestra Y, or if kind of the universality of what you just now were talking about means that, in a sense, you can get up in front of any audience, whether it would be an audience for the RSO or an audience for the MSO or for the New York Philharmonic, for that matter, and speak about music in largely the same fashion. Do you understand the question? I'm wondering.
I do. Yeah, okay. I do, and I can absolutely speak to that because I have given pre-concert talks for the Cleveland Orchestra and the Philadelphia Orchestra, which are known to be some of the top orchestras in the country.
Absolutely.
And the curiosity of the audience is no different. I've been in a smaller city. I think people who attend orchestra concerts are, other than a very small fraction of people who are maybe, you know, looking at it from a more academic standpoint, for the most part, anyone who attends an orchestra concert is looking for music to make them feel something, whether that's the New York Philharmonic or, you know, the smallest part-time orchestra. Anyone who is in that audience wants the music to make them feel something. And I feel like my job is to help guide the audience in having a better listening experience, help them get even more out of that listening experience by giving them information that makes them take that music and relate it to their own lives and their own experiences. And that's the same with anyone. So I really don't approach it any differently. I start with the music. I start with what the music makes me feel, what that music might make other people feel. And then I go into detail from there. And I find that when I take questions are the same everywhere. people want to know things about the composers' lives, what they were going through. They want to know what's happening on stage and why. Maybe that's the most universal thing that I have seen from audience questions. We take it for granted when we are orchestral players that we understand why there's no tuba on stage for a Mozart symphony. But most audience members have no idea. They don't know that a romantic orchestra or a 20th century orchestra has typically a different instrumentation from classical work. They don't understand that a large orchestra like the Milwaukee Symphony might have three contracted players in a section, so they rotate who plays what. And that's what I find. People just want to know, well, why did that guy go off stage and this other person came on stage when they switched pieces? Like, why is there only a piano on stage for one part of the concert? They're just so curious about those little logistical things. And I think it's because orchestras are celebrities to them. I mean, we are like sports teams, you know, those players who are on stage with the Racine Symphony, they are really sort of musical gods, I think, to anyone in the audience. And people in the audience want to know things about them, and they want to know why these things are happening. And one of my favorite things to do when I give pre-concert talks in Milwaukee, I usually get some complimentary tickets as a part of that. And I use my comp tickets to bring my friends who have never been to the symphony. And I get them to come to my pre-concert talk, and then I sit with them. And in between movements and in between pieces, they always have follow-up questions. And they say, oh, it's so great to sit next to you, because it's like we get to have this running commentary and all these things that I would normally sit here by myself and wonder. I can ask you these things at the intermission. And, you know, I've got friends asking me, so tell me about Triangle Guy. Like, what do you mean, tell you about Triangle Guy? Well, if Timpani Guy goes down, does Triangle Guy have to jump into his spot? Like, this is how people are approaching things. And I think it's wonderful. They're watching. They're listening. There's so much curiosity there. And I love being able to enlighten people on all those little details.
Fantastic. Do you find that there are certain pieces that, in a sense, need more help from you than others? I mean, that there are certain pieces of music that if for some reason you couldn't be there, or you just forgot or whatever, or ran out of time, that they are very easily enjoyed and appreciated without much in the way of spoken introduction and commentary, versus others where the typical audience member is likely to be bewildered or bored or really not grasp the greatness of a piece. Do you think there's a fairly significant difference?
Definitely. In fact, I always say the most difficult pre-concert talk I ever gave was on Beethoven 5, because what do I have to add? Everyone knows it. Everyone loves it. They're already there to hear it. How am I going to help people find something new and enjoy more about Beethoven 5? So that was actually really hard for me to figure out what angle I was going to take in talking about Beethoven 5. I have a much easier time finding ways to talk about pieces that might be more difficult for audiences. And that tends to be newer music. It tends to be 20th century music, 21st century music, things that don't have a clear-cut melody, things that don't have an easy-to-listen-to harmony. Audiences struggle with those pieces more. And so I try to help them understand those pieces coming from the angle that not all music has to be beautiful and relaxing and calming. Not all music has to make us feel happy and good to make us feel something. It can still have a really profound effect on us. And if you think about it in terms of film, some people, you know, they love romantic comedies because they know there's going to be a happy ending. But most people, I think, would also be willing to watch, you know, like kind of a dark and disturbing drama or a horror movie. And you don't watch those kind of films in order to feel great and happy and relaxed. You watch them because you like being made to think about something that's hard to think about. You like what a documentary about a horrible event in our world's history makes you think and feel, and it helps you grow as a person to think about those things. You like watching a scary movie because you like the feeling of being scared. And we can do that with music, too. We can listen to a piece of music that is atonal and jagged and kind of uncomfortable. And rather than not enjoying that, getting away from that idea that, like, oh, I'm just going to sit back and enjoy this piece, but thinking, like, what is this piece meant to make me feel? Maybe I don't want to feel that, and I have to come to terms with the fact that that feeling makes me uncomfortable. These are the things that make us human. And what I have often told my audience is, I would rather have you hate a piece of music and know why you hate it than be indifferent to it and just kind of grit your teeth through it. If a piece of music is making you feel uncomfortable, if you're thinking, wow, I really don't like this, listen a little more closely and think, why? You know, why don't I like this? What about this piece of music makes me not have a pleasurable experience? I think a lot of people tend to go and, you know, they see something that's a newer piece of music on the program and they go, oh boy, I got to sit through this in order to get to Beethoven or Haydn or Mozart. And I challenge my audience members, don't just sit through it and think automatically, I'm not going to like this. Think, what can I learn about myself, about the world from listening to this piece of music? Maybe that's going to be challenging, but by being an audience in a concert, we're accepting a challenge. You know, orchestra music, live music of any kind is not just entertainment. It's there to make us think and feel. And so, yes, there are definitely pieces that require a little bit more discussion, and I try to bring as much information into those pieces as I can about why a composer might write a piece of music that way. Alban Berg was living at the end of the worst war that the world had ever seen and was on the cusp of another one, and you just don't write pretty major chords and lovely melodies when, you know, you're feeling that way about the world that you live in.
Well, fortunately, the audience on Sunday afternoon is going to be treated to really three wonderful works and three very enjoyable works, symphonies by Haydn and Beethoven and Mendelssohn's atmospheric Hebrides Overture. And
I was just going to say there's not going to be too much that is more of a challenge here, but right, there is some real darkness in this music. I mean, the second movement of Beethoven's Seventh Symphony is this incredible layering of this ostinato dirge, this repeating dark rhythm over and over again that works its way from darkness into light and back to darkness again. And it's a very intense and solemn and moving piece. And the Hebrides Overture as well, it's atmospheric, but it's an atmospheric piece about kind of a dark and scary and stormy place. So there are some really wonderful stories to be told in this music.
Well, people can hear you tell those stories on Sunday afternoon with your pre-concert conversation, 2 o'clock in Bedford Hall. And then, of course, the concert follows at 3. And more information is available at racinesymphony.org. And Megan Heinrich, the artist in residence for the Racine Symphony, thank you so much for joining me today. It was a real pleasure to hear from you.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
And here are the last few moments of Beethoven's magnificent Seventh Symphony, one of the works to be played by the Racine Symphony Orchestra this weekend. You're listening to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. It's exactly 8:35. Earlier this week, on the 30th of September, The world was shocked by the news of the death of Jessie Norman, one of the most renowned singers of her time. Back in 2014, I had the profound privilege of interviewing Miss Norman about her recently published memoir. I want to share with you a portion of that morning show as it aired back in 2014. Incidentally, the complete interview is going to be offered up this weekend on the Saturday and Sunday podcast of The Morning Show with Greg Berg. But here is The Morning Show from 2014 with Miss Norman as it aired. That magnificent voice and distinctive artistry belongs to none other than Jessie Norman, one of the most splendid, most acclaimed, most recognizable singers of her generation. She has sung with great distinction on just about every major opera and concert stage around the globe, called upon to sing for some of the most important events of her time, including two different presidential inaugurations, the ceremony for which President Jimmy Carter received the Nobel Peace Prize, and many other important occasions. A recipient of the Kennedy Center Honors, the National Medal of the Arts, 5 Grammy Awards, amongst many other honors and awards too numerous to mention here. And now she is also the writer of a beautifully crafted, deeply meaningful memoir titled Stand Up Straight and Sing, which is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, which recounts many events, although by no means all, of the memorable events in her extraordinary life and career. And I am deeply honored to be able to spend the next few minutes speaking with Jessie Norman about her life and career and her beautifully written memoir, again titled Stand Up Straight and Sing. Jessie Norman, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be with you.
Thank you so much. Miss Norman, I've had the pleasure of experiencing your singing several times in person and, of course, many, many times beyond that on television and on recordings and so on. Specifically in person, I had the pleasure of seeing you at the Lyric Opera of Chicago in the title role of Gluck's Alceste and twice at the Ravinia Festival. One concert featured, a portion of Samson and Delilah, and actually the first time I saw you at Ravinia was from the front row center, where I saw you in Act One of Wagner's Die Walküre in the role of Sieglinde. And I want to ask you a little bit about that, what was a memorable night for all of us who were there. But first, for the sake of our listeners who were not so fortunate, I want to play just a little bit of the recording of Der Männersippe from Act One of Die Walküre. And conducting this Deutsche Grammophon recording as he conducted that performance that night at Ravinia, the great James Levine. So here is the voice of Miss Jessie Norman. Thank you. I can't get over the thrilling sounds that you made, and it brings me back to that memorable night at Ravinia. And I remember telling friends of mine, as I tried to describe it, I felt like I was taking a bath in the sound of a singer. I'd never experienced that before. It was just incredible.
Thank you.
I wonder for you, who, of course, heard yourself sing all your life and, of course, know all these recordings inside out, I should think. For you, is it possible for you to be thrilled by the sound the same way that we are in the public who listen to these recordings, or do you know your voice too well to react to it in that kind of way?
I think it would be quite impossible for a performer to react in the same way that an audience would from any kind of performance, whether it's from dancing or playing the piano or the violin or singing, because we know what we intended to do at every point. On every syllable, and sometimes that's exactly what we wanted, sometimes it wasn't, so one is more concerned and I think more thoughtful about the performance itself rather than just relaxing and being able to enjoy it as a performance, because it's simply too personal. And I don't think that it's possible to be really objective. I might be wrong in that as far as other people are concerned, but certainly in my experience, I find that I'm so busy listening to, gosh, I would have done that differently. and so I'm not terribly sort of relaxed when I'm listening to myself.
Right. I can understand. Well, I thoroughly loved your book. And I am so glad that you were intent on writing something other than the more typical, and then I sang this at that opera house memoir that a lot of singers, of course, have given us. Obviously wanted this book to be something different. Tell us just a little bit about how it actually took shape, how you put this book together, and with what intent.
Well, my intent was to give the history, actually, of an American family, and particularly in an American situation, the time of the civil rights movement in the 60s, I wanted to talk about that in a different way. We've heard, of course, from all of the great icons of the past who were involved in this movement and what they did and how it changed, actually, the history of our country. But these small stories about individual families, we don't hear quite enough about that.
Absolutely.
And I wanted to speak to the idea of being involved in the movement, but at the same time being able to grow up in a loving, wonderful, supportive community so that one understood one's own self and had a sense of one's awareness in this world that was not colored by what was happening historically in our country, because there were people around you that told you every day that you were loved, that you were as good as anyone else in God's creation, and that you might have to work a little harder to prove that. But that was simply the way the world was working at the moment, and that we needed to accept it, but at the same time to know that you could do anything that you set your mind to do, because that was your birthright. Hmm.
You do tell that story so very, very well. And my understanding is that you wrote this book, you wrote this memoir, without a ghostwriter. Certainly, it's only your name on the cover.
Oh, absolutely.
I wonder, were you at all intimidated by the prospect of writing a memoir without the aid of a professional writer?
I wasn't at all intimidated. I started, of course, at the behest of my publisher to try to work with a person that was going to be a collaborator on the book. And soon into the writing of the book, it became very clear to me that the person that was meant to help me in this way, Deneen Milner, who does her name does appear in the acknowledgments, that we had a completely different way of using language. And that whereas I appreciated her being a professional writer, that I had to tell this story in my own way with my own voice. And so it became very clear that I would need someone to help me to arrange the material, and that I would write, and that we would simply make sure that everything that had to do with the same subject was in the same place in the book. But other than that, I decided that whether or not it would be considered the right idea, that I simply had to speak in my own voice.
Hmm. Well, it's a great choice. I'm glad that choice is ultimately the one that was made.
Thank you.
The book, of course, as you've already touched upon, celebrates the community you come from, and especially your wonderful family, and not just your parents and siblings, but other parts of your family tree as well, aunts, uncles, cousins, and especially your grandparents. I love how at one point you write, "It was nourishing on every possible level to be seated at my grandparents' table." I just think that's a beautiful way to put that. But tell us about some of the most important ways in which your family provided you nourishment, and particularly your grandparents.
Well, it was so wonderful to be able to visit my grandparents on their farm, because it was rather different from living in the city, even though I was growing up in what would certainly at the time have been considered a small town. But going to their place where there was, you know, fruit trees and things that growing on the ground, melons and things that you could actually just walk around, I considered it really sort of our little private Garden of Eden, because it was just marvelous, all of the things that were growing that you could actually put on the table and eat. And so most of the things that we had at those marvelous dinners were things that had actually been grown on the farm.
Wow.
And so that was especially nourishing, just to know that that could happen, that there was something other than the A&P from which one could get food, and that it tasted completely differently from the things that one had normally. And so it was just marvelous to be there with them and to see my mother become a daughter when we would go and visit my grandmother. It was a wonderful thing to see, to hear my mother calling somebody else mother. And then to do what she said, and to, "Mother, do you want it like this? And is this all right?" And all the rest of it. I just found it really kind of beautiful to watch. And to be with my cousins and my uncles and my aunts and all the rest of it, it was always great fun. And we always had so much talking to do to catch up with everybody's business since the last time we'd been together. So it was always full of conversation and just full of joy to be together.
You describe yourself more than once in your memoir as a little girl who really wasn't afraid to get involved in what we think of as more boyish kinds of activities and adventures. What was it that attracted you so to the kind of things that your brothers and their friends were doing? And I also wonder what your parents made of this, the fact that you, who were in some ways a typical little girl, also really wanted to sort of blur the lines between what little girls and what little boys do.
Well, I think that I wished to, as you put it, blur the lines, because it seemed to me, and I speak to this in the book, that my brother, Howard, who's 4 years younger than I, that he seemed to have more freedom in his choice of things to do than I, who was older than he, because he happened to be a boy. And I was interested, there were more boys, I think, on our street than girls, and so they were always at the baseball games and the softball games and so on. They seemed to be having so much fun, and they would only invite the girls that they kind of felt like it. And I was always wanting to do what they were doing because they seemed to have so much fun at it. And I think I probably was interested in it because it was something that I was told, well, girls don't do that. And girls don't sort of run and play softball in the street. I mean, you just can't do that. And because I thought, well, why not? That was exactly what I wanted to do, as it was that I wanted to learn to take shop in middle school. Then I was interested in taking home economics. I didn't see any point in spending time trying to learn how to cook or to learn how to sew when my mother could tell me that. But there was no one to teach me how to make a table particularly.
I love how that story ends with what I think you describe as sort of the crowning blow, or the greatest indignity of all, when the girls of the home ec class were supposed to serve a meal to the boys from the shop class, which really affronted you in a very serious way.
Oh, it did. It still does.
To this day. in your life, and of course, not just within your childhood, but really through into adulthood, of course, perhaps to some extent even to today, two specters, of course, that have been shadows have been sexism and racism.
Yes.
And of course, you've already touched on the fact that thanks to such a loving family and loving community, you still had an incredibly happy, full childhood, and of course have gone on to live such a splendid life. But still, this has been a reality, both racism and sexism. I wonder, looking back, which was more frustrating and felt more oppressive to you at the time, or which of those were you more maybe aware of on a daily basis, racism versus sexism?
Well, I would say that I was surely aware of racism before I was aware of sexism, and I was aware of racism at a very young age. But sexism was something that I came to understand a bit later, and certainly when I think about it now, I'm not really able easily to separate the two in my mind, because so often they are walking hand in hand, and they still do. And it would be wonderful to say that we've gotten over the racism in our country and in the world, but of course that is not true. And these people that have been writing and speaking about a post-racial atmosphere in our country, I don't know what country they could be speaking about at all, because that certainly is not true here, and it isn't true anywhere else in the world either. And it is unfortunate for all of us that this is the case, but it is simply the truth. And racism and sexism have no place in a civilized society, and they never have. And the people that want to stoke the fires of racism and sexism continually are simply wrongheaded.
You've touched on the fact already that your parents did such a marvelous job, and for that matter, your whole family, but particularly your parents, such a marvelous job of striking a balance between allowing you to know about the harsh realities of the world and yet cloaking you and your siblings in this warm assurance that you were loved and that you were capable of great things.
Yes.
Tell us how they managed to do that. I mean, what kinds of things did they say or do that allowed that kind of balance to be achieved?
Yes, well, aside from the general atmosphere in the house, it can sometimes be very difficult to say this is what happened and this was the result. I can only say that somehow my parents rearranged their days and their lives to be at various activities in which we participated as children. Even if we were doing something as simple as I did very often, to sing a song at the school assembly once a week, somehow my parents arrived, you know, minutes before I would sing and would be there while I sang. And then, of course, they had to go back to their work. But somehow they were always there. And I didn't really understand how it is that perhaps a lot of other parents weren't there. I just thought they had jobs where they couldn't leave and that they weren't able to be there for their own children. But my father was the president of the PTA, my mother was the auditor of the church, my father was the superintendent of the Sunday school and the chairman of the trustee board of the church. So they were very involved in what was going on in the community, and therefore we had those icons, our own parents, to watch and to see how one would conduct an adult life. And so that was in its way nourishing and encouraging and certainly educational.
Hmm.
But we talk about this a lot, my siblings and I, because they, of course, as I mentioned in my book, they are busy being parents and have always wondered how did our parents really, as you say, strike that balance to be really good parents, but at the same time, which is important for everyone to understand, at the same time, they weren't pushing us. They weren't terrorizing us. They wanted us to do as well as we could, but there wasn't. Somehow they did this without putting pressure on us. We still do not understand exactly how that happened, except that it did happen, and that we were happy to make them happy because it meant so much to them.
For those of you just joining us, I am speaking today with the marvelous singer Jessie Norman about her memoir called Stand Up Straight and Sing, which has just been published. Ms. Norman, I absolutely love a story that you tell about your mother, an incredibly busy, active woman committed to so many good causes. And in particular, you talk about the work she did to help African Americans register to vote.
Yes.
And you would often be with her at those sessions where people would come and get registered. I think maybe in the lobby, the narthex of your church, perhaps?
The annex of the church.
Yes, right.
Absolutely, very often.
And you tell a story about something that she would do from time to time. That is, she would periodically ask you to step away without explanation. And only, I think, many years later did you have the opportunity to ask her why she would sometimes have you step away. Tell our listeners about that.
Well, it was my job to sit with her, and we had 3x5 index cards. Remember 3x5 index cards? On which everybody's name that came to register to vote was printed, was written, and with their address and telephone number and all of that. And that was kind of my little job when people were coming to her table. And from time to time, she would ask me to step away to get something to drink or something like that. And I understood that I was being asked to step away, but I didn't really understand why all the time. And it was certainly years later. I was already university. And I asked her, you know, why was that? Because I really feel that maybe there was something going on that I wasn't supposed to know or something. And my mother, very quietly, she hardly ever spoke a word louder than this. And she said it was because a number of the people that were registering to vote had not yet learned to write. And they would have to sign their names with an X, and I would have to, in their presence and with a witness, write their name on the card. And there was no reason for you to see this, because I didn't wish them to be at all embarrassed.
Mm-hmm.
And that was that kind of behavior was exactly the essence of my mother.
Mm. Such a compassion for other people, and especially wanting to safeguard the dignity of everyone.
Absolutely, absolutely.
That's so beautiful.
She was that way. And when I tell the story about it, says anybody that knows her says, yes, of course she would have done that. That would have been exactly the way your mother would have behaved. And I try to learn from her still in my dealings and interactions with people.
Mm. Renowned singer Jesse Norman, who passed away on the 30th of September. This interview with Jesse Norman was recorded back in 2014. Tomorrow and Sunday, on the podcast version of this program, I will be airing this interview in its entirety, and it includes additional examples of Jesse Norman's magnificent singing. We remind you that The Morning Show as a podcast is available on all the major podcast platforms, including